Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
I'm Steph. Welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm here with the full crew again. Pat.
Hello.
Heather.
Hi.
Teresa.
Hi.
Nicola.
Hello.
And Linda.
Hi.
We've got a full agenda this week on Write Club. Heather's going to read to us from her work in progress, and then we'll offer her some feedback, just like we do in our own Write Club meetings. Pat's got something to say about the vagaries of English spelling. And then we're going to talk about writing groups and how valuable they are. We'll be talking about our own Write Club and some of your groups as well. And finally, we're going to hear what Linda and Susanna Marriott are reading at the moment. But first, Nicola is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Okay, so this was first published in 1978. It is set in a post-apocalyptic future. There is a flu in town, which is known as Captain Trips.
Ooh, Captain Trips.
A flu.
Blank.
Oh, good. Mm. I've managed to get clue one past Teresa.
Absolutely.
Not for long, though, I suspect.
Go on.
After the flu, the surviving humans start dreaming either of, in fact, they start dreaming about both, a Drac cowboy or a little old lady in a Nebraskan cornfield.
Okay, I think I have
they're
it.
Drawn
I'm writing
to one or
it.
The other.
Well, I'm I don't know. I've got it. No, that's too. 78 is too late for that, yeah. I think. Okay, carry on.
Yeah. Oh, down to clue number three.
Clue three, you've got it, Nicola.
Okay, you've got okay. me.
You can probably go to 33 for me.
The cornfields are a recurring theme in this author's work, as are dark cowboys.
Well, I thought it might be Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, but that's
no.
earlier. And then I thought Children of the Corn.
No.
Corn.
Oh, I was so excited.
Wait, is it Field of Dreams?
No.
Oh, all I'm thinking is David Lynch, but that's TV.
Yeah, we're all not so close, but not there. It's The Stand by Stephen King.
The Stand.
a lot of people consider it to be one of his finest books, and it's recently been rewritten. It won countless awards. It was turned into a TV miniseries, and it's one of my favourite books of all time. It's absolutely fantastic.
And I've never heard of it, and
I've never read it.
No, it's basically the fight between good and evil. Okay. And how people are drawn, they start having dreams about this little old lady in a cornfield in Nebraska, and they start to travel towards her if they're overwhelmingly a good person, but they also have dreams about Randall Flagg, the dark cowboy.
Wow.
And the people who've lived more difficult lives or who are drawn to the dark side are drawn to Las Vegas to go and and it's the last stand, basically, of humankind.
Wow.
Brilliant.
Sounds really good. Sounds really good.
Well done.
So yeah, you've got us. You've got us.
Did anybody...
Mind you, it's a very obscure author.
I've never read any Stephen King, I don't think.
I don't read a lot of it because it's a lot of it's horror rather than... But this did have a little... few bits of that weren't so pleasant, but it's more about the story itself.
Sounds interesting.
Well,
sounds
if you
good.
Got it, I'd like you to go onto our Facebook group and put us all to shame and tell us that you got it on clue one, two or three, and we'll see who was the winner.
Right.
And if you want to read it, I would definitely pick up one of the later versions, because he's done a lot of he missed a lot out at the beginning and he's done a lot of clarification. He feels it's a better book now.
Right.
Yeah. I'm amazed Stephen King had to rewrite something after it was already
He didn't have to, he felt he wanted to.
He chose to.
Yes, he chose to.
Thanks, Nicola. That was
very
excellent.
Good.
Very good. Now, we're looking forward to hearing from Heather. She's going to read to us from her work in progress. Heather, before you start reading, do you want to give us a bit of context and background?
This story is one of a collection of stories around safeguarding vulnerable adults, which was my job before I retired. And this is, it's not a real case. It's not directly from what happened. It's a
composite.
Yeah, composite of a few cases and of things that I want to get off my chest and out of my head. Emma was surprised by a knock at her door. She never had visitors and she wasn't expecting anyone, so I'd no idea who it could be. The door was knocked again, and she worried that whoever it was would give up and go before she could get to the door. Even with the help of her frame, she moved very slowly. She was greeted by a cheerful young man who explained that he was doing a job for one of her neighbours, and he noticed that a couple of slates were missing from her roof. He told her that if she didn't have the roof sorted out, she could have problems with damp in the bedrooms. Emma hesitated, but realised that she had no idea how she could get the roof repaired, and agreed to let him do the work for her. He told her that it would cost about £300. The following day, the young man knocked on the back door as he walked into the kitchen. Emma was surprised, but thought it would be rude of her to say anything to him. She gave him a cup of tea and offered him a biscuit. He seemed very nice and his manners were impeccable. She talked to him for some time and said that, like her, he had no close family and that he understood how lonely she must be. He finished his tea and got to work on the roof, setting the ladder against the back wall. For some time there was knocking and banging on the roof, and then he came into the kitchen and said that the work was finished, that he was afraid it would cost £350 as he replaced more tiles than expected. She thought that must be a fair price because he looked so innocent. She went into her sitting room and took the money out of her tin. She had not used the bank for some years and had relied on cash. She asked him for a receipt and he agreed. He took the money and left with a cheery wave. A couple of weeks later, there was a knock on the door and Emma made her way slowly down the hall and opened the door. A solemn young man introduced himself as Greg and told her that when he was passing a couple of weeks previously, he noticed someone working on a roof. It was the first chance he'd had to call to see if she was okay. He explained that not everyone did a good job, and asked if the chap who had done the work had checked her loft. Emma was horrified that poor work could have been carried out and asked the young man what she should do about it. He told her that he would have a look and see if everything was in order. She immediately let him in and thanked him for his concern and told him where the loft hatch was. He came back a few minutes later and said that unfortunately there was a damp patch that would need some attention very soon. She was so relieved he had found the damp and was able to sort it out. She asked him to do the work. He told her that he would come back in the morning.
Oh dear.
I know.
Oh dear. Poor Emma.
This could go on.
So fearful
on
for her.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
She's so trusting.
Mm-hmm. Exactly what
she
I've
keeps
written.
Her money in a tin and
she lets them see.
Yeah, and she gets it. Oh.
You can imagine how there are rings of these people who just go, you know, 2 weeks later go and see about this and 2 weeks later go and say about that.
They do. It's awful. Yeah. It's dreadful.
I mean, the facts behind that is that it really does happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are gangs of people who go around the country and they target. They go up and down roads. They're looking for houses with peeling paint, with, you know, sort of overgrown gardens and quite often close to motorway junctions where it's easy, you know, to network
coming
the country. And a lot of older people don't tell anybody about it because they're ashamed and embarrassed.
I felt sort of frightened when the young man came in the door to the kitchen and didn't knock or anything. But he has impeccable manners, so.
Any
other comments?
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't enough to do this story justice, actually. You know, we're trying to keep it in under a certain time limit. And I read the whole story and it really did escalate. And you really get into the emotions of the person concerned. And as part of a collection of stories, I think it really worked.
One of the things I wanted to pick up on as a critique, you tend to under-punctuate. So when you put commas in where there should be full stops, but when you read, you're putting full stops in.
Yeah.
And I noticed that. So you said Emma was surprised by a knock at her door. You stopped. She never had visitors and she wasn't expecting anyone. So you actually put the full stop in when you're reading. And I noticed it later on as well that you did exactly the same thing. So you've got a comma after on her roof. But when you read, a solemn young man introduced himself as Greg and told her that when he was passing a couple of weeks previously, he noticed someone working on her roof. Stop, you stopped. Mm. So you do know, you know, when you read it aloud, you do. But you kind of, I think because you do, you know, you write in this very flowing style that you tend to underpunctuate. So that's a little thing that I picked up on. But I feel like you're sort of, you've got the bones of a narrative, you know. And I would like to see a bit more colour and personality coming through. I don't know if other people felt that.
Yeah,
that
was mainly
that,
my
but, you know,
point, I think.
Yeah. I'd like to actually hear the voices rather than the reported.
But you said, because I think you said you go back, don't you? So is, that would be a good place to put the dialogue.
I am going back. I've listened, and you've said it before, that I don't use very much dialogue, so I don't add that. So I am trying to go back. Mm-hmm. And when I go, and I'll try and do that.
And that, that gives you the possibility then of showing, not telling. Yeah. So you can show his impeccable manners.
Yes,
exactly. Rather than tell us he's got them.
So he can come in and say, "Good morning, Mrs. So-and-so," and he can touch his forelock and stand to attention.
Exactly, that means different things to different people.
Exactly,
doesn't
so
it?
Then that's you wouldn't need to tell us he had impeccable manners.
Yeah.
Well, you could say that she was impressed.
Yeah.
By his attentiveness or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I've read pieces of yours in which you have done dialogue, and you write beautiful dialogue. And so I was thinking maybe that what you're doing, what I should do, and just forge on ahead and then go back and put that in. Yeah. Is that what you intend?
Yes.
Okay,
But what I really was impressed with was you're absolutely consistent on point of view. This is only Emma's point of view, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely consistent. Yeah. We never slipped into one of the young men or something else. And that makes it really powerful, because that makes the approaches of these young men quite sinister.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it definitely built in sinisterness.
Builds the conflict.
without sinistry. But using plain language, you know, it's quite... You know, it's simply told, but that makes it all the more chilling, doesn't it? You're not trying to build atmosphere. We just feel that dread for her because we know
every time the doorbell goes.
But I
still feel that without, I think the dialogue would give a greater sense of character. And at the moment, I feel that we're kind of standing back, observing, and it would, if you had a greater sense of character, then that would make it easier. To engage and empathise with her. At the minute, it's too easy to think, oh dear, that's terrible.
We're a bit detached because we're overviewing the whole story. But if that's, you know, Heather's process, that she gets the stories out and then goes back to
dramatise
it. That's a perfectly valid
Absolutely.
I've got to say, the words just tumble out.
Yes.
I sit with a laptop and it all just pours out and I just write and write and write.
But I think this is a great place to start. You know, Emma's sitting having a cup of tea, minding her own business, and there's a knock at the door. And I know what you were saying about the whole story, but the whole story tells us when she was born.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we don't need to know when she was born in order to understand what's happening to her in this instance. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
So it's what they call in media res, you know, arrive in the middle of the action.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're arriving with a knock at the door. We don't even know what she was doing when the door knocked.
Yeah.
All we know is that something...
Yeah, we got straight into the story, don't we?
Which is great. Yeah, really good.
Very good.
I understand you've got something to tell us about the vagaries of English spelling.
Yeah, I thought I'd have a little departure from my usual grammar detective thing. So I've got a little conundrum for you, and you might need to write this down.
Blimey.
Okay. What does the following spell? G-H-O-T-I.
Okay. Gotti.
Goatee.
Goatee, I'd say.
I would say gotti.
It's a ghost, isn't it?
You might say that. But according to George Bernard Shaw, it could be fish.
Ah, okay.
George Bernard Shaw was pronounced very keen.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Was very keen that English spelling should be completely changed to become phonetic, i.e. things should be spelled as they sound. And if English spelling were phonetically consistent, then fish might well be spelt that way. You've got GH, as in laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
Laugh or
yeah,
laugh.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very good.
O, as in women.
Yeah.
And T-I, yeah, as in station.
Yes.
Yes.
So, say fish.
Eh. Sure.
Very good, very good.
Clever.
But apparently only about 1 in 10 words in English is not spelt the way it sounds, which is probably why spelling causes so many problems for so many people. And the reasons for the huge variety in the way that words are spelt are all to do with our history. And our history, of course, is one of invasions. And each new group of invaders added new words and new spellings. So the story starts with the missionaries who first wrote English down as best they could using the Roman alphabet and the Latin that they knew. And they made quite a reasonable job of it once they found extra letters to cope with the Germanic sounds that they didn't have in Latin. And apparently the spelling of Old English was largely phonetic and all letters were pronounced. So they pronounced the G in gnat, so gnat, the K in no. No,
yeah,
in yeah. Old English. But then the French arrived with their own ideas about how to spell, and they obviously changed some of the old forms, introduced new ones. Medieval scribes continued to spell words as they were pronounced, but as English had many regional accents, I mean, it still does, but we've yeah. lost so many, the result was a huge amount of variation. In the Middle Ages, there were over 60 spellings of knight are known from the Middle Ages. So you had N-I-T-E, N-I-C-H-T, and so on. But as England developed a centralised government, they felt they needed a more standardised system of language. But then, of course, the argument was, whose standard should it be? English translations of the Bible, widely read authors such as Chaucer, printers, but the printers were from the Netherlands anyway, so that didn't really help. And there was still a great deal of variation, so in the 16th century, spelling reformers came up with the big idea, etymology. And if the word meaning money owed appeared in such varied ways as D-E-T, D-E-double-T, and D-E-Y-double-T, then obviously something needed to be done. And this would come from the word's history. The word was debitum in Latin, so they recommended a silent B to reference the fact that it had come from the Latin. And that idea caught on, as did the B in subtle and the L in salmon, the P in receipt, and so on. But actually, in trying to simplify the system, the reformers ended up complicating it. And so in the 19th century, there was another big change. Previously, foreign words that came into English would tend to have their spellings anglicised. So the German noodle, N-U-D-E-L, gave us noodles, N-O-O-D-L-E, in the 16th century. But in the modern era, this policy was reversed. Strudel arrived at the end of the 19th century, and we spell it the German way, with the U. We don't spell it with the double O. So thousands of words retained their original spelling in this way, and we sort of respect the foreign spellings these days. And so that really is why it's all so complicated and so many people have so many problems with spelling.
Yeah.
Apparently, according to onepoll.com, the word most commonly misspelt is separate.
Yeah. Oh, I struggle with that.
It's the second vowel that you have to think. Is it an A or an E?
Separate has a rat in it.
Clever.
That's why you have all those little sort of mnemonics and things, isn't it? The second most commonly misspelt is definitely.
Oh, yes. Another one. People put defiantly.
Yeah.
Or definitely.
Definitely.
Yes.
I defiantly think that, which actually works in some cases. And of course, you haven't covered on what the Americans then did.
No. That's another story.
That's for another day. But my personal favourite misspelling is one from my teaching days. Okay. M-E-T-A-N-T-A-T-E-R-P-I.
Meat and tater pie.
That's
That's great.
I kid you not.
Yeah, that is great. But going back to the silent K. Never mind. I've got a Danish friend, and they still pronounce the K. So all of those words in English, knife, knife, knee, presumably came with the Viking, those ones. Mm. And there's... I must look up this poem and see if I can post it on the Facebook page. But there's a poem which has all these really, you know, things that shouldn't rhyme or, you know, awkward to spell English words.
There's one that's almost, well, the first verse is all about the O-U-G-Hs and the coughs.
Yes, the coughs and the bows and the throws and the bows.
Yes. It is a minefield.
It is.
Thank you, Pat. That was really good. I enjoyed that. I love the fish as well.
Yeah, that's a good stuff.
We still have to explain it to Nicola. She's not got it.
I haven't either.
No, I vaguely have here. Right. We'll do it off air. Now, we've been meeting as a writing group for about 18 months now, and we're here to support one another in our efforts to be the best writers we can be. And we believe that the feedback that we get from one another is invaluable. But I've spoken to a few other writing groups about what they're getting from it. And for example, Christina Lushberger has a writing group which is dubbed the Writing Circus. And they are a group of just four people, two writers and two readers, who meet weekly. And the readers read and the writers write.
That's very interesting.
Which is very interesting. Yeah, it's very different.
Are the readers reading the writers' work?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Okay.
So they all write together with the free write, but the reading, the main reading and critiquing is done of the writer's work. So that's very
and
nice.
And they don't swap roles?
No.
They just do?
No.
Okay.
Well, that would keep you having to churn it out, wouldn't it?
So the readers coordinate among themselves to see who's bringing what, and they talk out their writer's blocks, but they meet weekly. Unlike us, we meet fortnightly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we meet a lot to talk about the podcast and to do the podcast, but we actually do our Write Club meeting. The format of our Write Club meetings is we start with a free write.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Heather, what do you like about the free write?
I think the best thing about it is the critique of what you've written. And I find that very helpful, especially with the dialogue thing that we talked about previously. I don't naturally fall into writing dialogue. The three rights taught me how to do that, and that's by the feedback from the rest of the group.
Yeah.
So I find that very
good. What
very
do you good. Like about the free write, Teresa?
For me, it's like improvising in the theatre. I don't think I write. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what is going to come out of my pen when we do the free write. And then you start writing and suddenly think, oh, now where am I going with this? What have I got to do? Mm-hmm. And it's thinking on your feet, and there are stories that come from nowhere. And I love that. It's exciting.
And like other writing groups, we do a critique of somebody's work. We normally critique a couple of us at a time, just like we do on the show here, perhaps go into a little bit more depth. Pat, what do you get from the critiquing sessions?
Oh, a lot. Yeah. I think just point, isn't it? Just I think having those other people's perspective can open up sort of avenues that you haven't thought of. Or when you get stuck, it's easy, I think, when you're writing and you've got something in your mind. And then somebody looks at it and finds something completely different there. It can either unblock paths that you need to sort of develop, or it can just send you in an interesting direction.
Mm-hmm.
It just adds to, I mean, it's your work, but other people's view of it can help you develop that work in a way that you might not otherwise have thought of.
And then from the writing groups I've spoken to, we do something quite different at the end of our meetings, because we have a technical session.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Nicola, I know in particular you've enjoyed the technical sessions, haven't you?
She's loved them.
Well, I've come at this completely cold, and I've read a lot of books, but I've never been in a situation to analyse why those books were good or not, and what made them good. So I love learning more about it. And, you know, you guys have introduced me to such concepts as points of view and show, not tell. And like you, Heather, I don't find writing dialogue comes very naturally. So you know, I'm getting better at that. And I'm also reading more critically now because I'm able to pick up on the things that you guys have taught me in the technical sessions. And I really enjoy the ones where we listen to a masterclass as well. That's really very cool.
I was going to come on to that. Linda, you've led writing groups and been a member of a number of different writing groups before, haven't you?
Yeah.
Could you give us some sort of view of what the best bits were?
Well, I attended one at Brown University after I had graduated, and I went back to just be a part of a writing group. It was we had a leader to this group. I think she was a teaching assistant or something who wanted to do this in her spare time. It was a rather large group. One or two people would submit and others would critique, but we didn't all share our critiques. It was just too big a group. And mostly they'd write down things and give you the written comments. And I enjoyed that very much, having the written comments handed in from people who hadn't spoken up. But I thought I didn't like the size of the group. It was far too, I mean, our group, we're friends. We have, you know, come to like and trust each other. And in a larger group like that, there was really not time to get acquainted. We didn't, you know, et cetera. I've had groups that are smaller. I had a group that was four people at one point, four women. We tried to introduce a man, and when he wrote something about a woman on a table and a man over her, we threw him out so fast. No, it was actually, we felt what he had done was to glorify the male character, which we wouldn't allow. And so the poor guy had to go. But in that group, since there were only the four of us, we all brought something. And we had turned it in beforehand, as we do here. And then we brought our critiques with us. The person would read, and then we would offer our suggestions. Didn't do anything other than read and critique. We didn't have technical sessions. We didn't do free write, you know. We kind of came, and what we had was basically a check-in. You know, how are you this week? Has anything happened that you need us to know, et cetera? That's it. So that's a couple of them.
Well, Teresa and I spoke to Andy Larter. Andy's a member of our Facebook group, and Andy came to us through the Facebook group and told us about his writing group. So let's listen to his interview now.
Today I'm talking to Andy Larter from the Eastcott Writers Group in Swindon. Hi, Andy.
Hello.
So, Andy, you started the Eastcott Writers Group. Can you tell us why you wanted to start a group?
I used to be a teacher. I retired just over 2 years ago. And during my time as a teacher, one of the things that I, well, in the later part of my teaching career, was I set up the A-level writing, creative writing course at the college that I was working in. And I'd always kind of been interested in writing. I'd always sort of enjoyed messing about, writing poems and stuff like that with the students that I taught throughout my career. But I'd never really got anything finished.
That sounds familiar.
Exactly. And then when I started teaching the A-level course, I met a couple of people who joined me in teaching it. And I sort of thought, you know, when I've got a bit more time, I ought to really try and get something finished. And I thought, well, one way of doing that, to keep the pressure on me, myself, is maybe start a writer's group. See who's interested. I've got some mates who might be interested. And that's why it started, really. I thought it would help me get something done.
Yeah.
Some friends get something done, and there might be people in the area who could come along and support and get their own writing done as well, because I know there are people who are interested in doing all kinds of different sorts of writing. So that's kind of why it started.
So when was that?
Just over 2 years ago.
So you've been going about 2 years.
Yeah, and in that time, the membership of the group has changed pretty radically. The people who came in the first place can't make it anymore. Don't attend, and there are about eight of us now. There are eight of us who meet fairly regularly, and they're not people who were there at the start. This is a changed clientele, if that's
Well, I guess things evolve, don't they? And you know, and perhaps it isn't for some people, it's not what they want or what they thought it was. So
yeah, and we're amateurs. You know, we're not. Yeah. It's not a professional group or anything like that. We're not being paid to do it.
No, no, but just like us.
Well, the commitments and they change over time as well.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's the way it is. Yeah.
So could you tell us, Andy, how you structure the meetings, what format your meetings take?
Well, the first thing is, and this is something that might put some people off, and I know it's put some people off in the past, is we start at 6 o'clock in the evening once a week on the first Tuesday of the month, and we meet for 3 hours. And in those 3 hours, we divide the time up so that the first hour is we give over to having a cup of tea and saying hello to each other and that sort of stuff. Then we do a short writing exercise, you know, one of those sort of, here's the opening sentence of a story, you've got 20 minutes to finish it kind of thing, those sorts of things. And then we have a cup of tea, and then we look at writing that members of the group have submitted in the previous month. And what we do then is we each bring our own printed copy, which we've annotated. We talk about it in a specific amount of time and then hand the writing over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the way that we do it, really. And it's, as I say, it's a 3 hour meeting. I think it goes really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We could do with another couple of hours, really, but there we go.
Or cut down on the chat at the beginning.
That's one of the most important bits.
Of course it is. Of course it is, having the catch up.
Yeah.
It sounds quite similar to what we do, actually.
Yeah.
So what are the benefits for you and for the other members of the group?
I think it's the regular kind of contact with people who have been reading your work and know it over a period of time, know the kinds of things that you write about, know the sort of weaknesses that people have and the strengths. So try to sort of build those up and help them get over the other stuff. I think it's having some people who take it seriously, but not seriously so that they're going to hurt you or upset you.
Mm. Yeah.
So we have a lot of fun. We talk about all kinds of things. Mm. But in the end, we know that we want to read each other's work.
Yeah.
We want to help each other do something with it.
Yeah.
It's that more than anything else, really. For me as well, having that commitment every month to saying, right, I'm going to write between 1,500, 2,000 words that I want to submit and give people, maybe say, you know, I've got a problem with this. Can you help me out?
Yeah.
But 2,000 words every month, I've got that kind of target and that sort of deadline really helps me do some writing.
Yeah, I totally agree, really. I think we all do a bit more than we would have done if we didn't have each other. And it's not really pressure. It's the commitment that you've said, I'll give you something to read.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'll just get involved in chopping up some vegetables and playing with the grandchildren, going for walks, get out my bike, that kind of thing, rather than sit down and write.
Yeah.
And how, when you critique one another, I mean, how pedantic and serious is the critique and the feedback?
Serious, because, well, one of the things that we do pick out things like internal flaws. You said this at the beginning, but then you say this at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We try to get over problems to do with, like, well, this bit didn't read particularly comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
I think it could do with thinking about how you present that love scene or that fight or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We get pedantic about things like the choice of word. There was one, either the last meeting or the meeting before, where somebody had used a word that we thought was a bit controversial.
Right.
The right word. We had a debate about that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't politically correct, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. This is somebody in our group who writes a bit, sort of family history things.
Mm-hmm.
And she's writing about somebody at the end of the Victorian era, and she used a word which would have been no problem in Victorian England.
Mm-hmm.
In 2018, it could be
problematic.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about that. I don't know what she's going to do with it. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, and that's the whole thing about critique, isn't it? You receive it, consider it, and then you take it or leave it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think now, after 2 years, the group's strong enough to know that that's the case.
Yeah.
So we're not afraid of giving each other our work then. As far as things like punctuation and grammar and that sort of stuff and spelling mistakes goes, I think we do that on the paper and then hand it over. I'm not too bothered about that at that stage.
Yeah,
that's a problem later on, I think.
Right. I get Pat to do that for me.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think about that though, but I've because when I taught the A level, I always said to the students, I'm not interested in punctuation at this stage. What I'm interested in is I want to see your ideas.
Yeah.
Let's take it from there. There might be the meaning might be problematic if you put a comma instead of a full stop or something. But in the main, I don't give a monkey's. I really don't care. You know, at this stage, later on, it becomes more problematic.
Yeah.
So it's like that, really.
Yeah. If you want to submit something, then you want to be sure that it's correctly punctuated and grammatically correct. But
first draft.
It's less important.
First draft. We have our own Facebook page as well.
Oh, I'll look for that.
I got a request the other day for somebody wants to join our group. They live in Burma.
Ah.
Right. Yeah. Or send them to us, because that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to create a virtual write club. We have our own writing group, just like you.
And that has a private Facebook page.
Yes, that has a private Facebook page. But that Write Club, the podcast, is really about creating that virtual writing group, encouraging people to share. So if you get people from Burma, please send them to us.
Okay, I'll do that.
Join us. Now, are you looking for any new members? I mean, would you like us to direct people to you? Or
Always welcome. But I don't know if you've experienced this as well, but I get requests from people who say, I'm really keen on writing. I'd really like to join your group. It sounds fantastic. And then we never see them.
Right.
Or we've had people come to one session and then we've never seen them again.
Yeah.
It's quite a leap of faith, isn't it, though, to put your work with people?
Oh, absolutely. And especially if you join a group where people know each other already.
Yeah. We kind of made a little manifesto between ourselves when we all got together about what we wanted to get out of it and how we were going to critique one another. Obviously, we now trust each other sufficiently, because I think we all understand that it's not to be unkind, it's to help us to be the best that we can be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we kind of respect one another's skill levels and so on.
We're honest, and we have that. You know, personally, I didn't know the other members of the group particularly well. I'd met Stephanie, but those friendships now are really, really strong, and we do have a strong trust. And like you, we talk about all sorts of things that are nothing or not directly related to writing. We've had some quite deep sessions about family therapy.
I think when you're discussing certain sort of words, controversial words, that brings out all kinds of issues that are not necessarily to do directly with writing. Yeah. But I think that's also a good personal.
Yes, absolutely.
Where do you meet?
We take it in turns to meet in one another's houses.
Right, okay. Because we meet at a local community hall.
Right.
So does that cost money?
It does, yeah. Mm-hmm. But for the last, so far, the last 2 years, two and a bit years, I've managed to find funding.
Ah!
First year, I managed to find some funding from the local council.
Right.
They paid us a sort of start-up money, which covered the whole year's rent. And for the last 2 years, a local literature charity. Have you ever heard of the Swindon Literature Festival? Quite a big event. Quite a big event. And there's a fella in town who organises that, and he gets money from all over the place. And he's given us enough money to cover the rent. I mean, it's, what, 25 quid a meeting?
So would you say to anybody starting up a writing group to go and, you know, who should they go and where should they start? So I'm starting up a writing group and I'm looking for funding. Where do I start?
Well, I'd look in places like that. Go to the council, see what they've got. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
Really
mm-hmm.
never know. I mean, what you're talking about, I don't know, 200, 250 quid?
Mm-hmm.
That's hardly anything, really, is it? I mean, to me it is.
Yes, but to the council it's very little. You're right.
And they might have a room somewhere or in the library or something like that. And there's another thing, the library.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of things going on or not going on in libraries and spaces that might be or might not be being used.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I did investigate that.
Yeah, brilliant.
Did you start your own group because there wasn't a group available that you could join, or did you want to own your own?
One of my friends kind of persuaded me that it'd be a good idea to set up our own.
Yeah.
In the local area.
Mm.
There are writers groups, very well established ones. A couple of them are very specific. Poetry, for example.
Right, yeah.
I don't have any objection to poetry, but that's not what I particularly want to write.
Yeah.
I've tried before on what I write is.
I bet it's not.
So that was Andy.
Nice man, very nice man. It was lovely to talk to him.
Well, it was interesting to hear about his group. I was kind of blown away by the fact that they spend an hour at the beginning chatting and catching up.
Because, oh, that's not allowed in this group.
No, none no.
15 minutes.
Yeah. And the other thing is that they meet in a public place, you know, sort of a place where they have to hire somewhere, whereas we all go to each other's houses, don't we?
So it's neutral territory, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose it is. And eight people, that's a lot of critiquing, isn't it, every month? But at least it makes everyone write something at least once a month. Mm. Perhaps we ought to adopt something similar.
I quite like the fact that you only have to submit once every 6 weeks for this group. That works for me. If you're interested in joining a writing group, maybe the library is a good place to start looking in your local area. And if there isn't one, think about starting one. And, you know, we've talked about various models of how you might run a writing group, but find a way that works for you. And
well, we did it.
Yeah, we did. If you know, obviously people are in different situations. Some people may be in very rural areas or living in a country where their language is not the main language. And so you can always make an online group as well. There are lots of options nowadays.
Yeah, so if you want to organise yourselves into smaller groups so that you can find people that have got the time to critique the work, maybe if they're not members of a writing group, because it is a commitment to critique one another's work. So, you know, we're fully occupied with each other's work, but there may be other people on the Facebook group who you can speak to and exchange critiques with. Maybe find people that are writing a similar genre to you.
Yeah.
There are groups for science fiction writers, for example.
I've joined a few.
You've joined a virtual science fiction group. So you've got there, you've got the company of people who know the genre that you're writing in.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, please do go onto our Facebook group and tell us how your writing group works and see if you can find some friends there to join a virtual group with.
Good idea.
Okay, well, it's nearly time to go for another week. But before we go, there's just time for us to hear from Susanna Marriott about what's on her bedside table. Susanna Marriott, Director of the Professional Writing Academy, what's on your bedside table?
I have huge amounts of stuff on my bedside table. I write non-fiction, so I have masses of non-fiction books, which I'm reading about four or five at a time. But I also always have works of fiction on the go as well. And the one I've chosen that's kind of really leapt out of me recently, I'm reading a lot at the moment. I'm enjoying Ali Smith's Winter, and I guess other people may have mentioned that because it's kind of a book of the moment. But the one I've chosen and the one I keep going back to is Tessa D'Urbervilles by Thomas Hardy. Yeah,
lovely.
I'm reading it at the moment. My youngest daughter is now 15. We've read together since she was about 9 months old. Every night we read together, and we are still doing it. I've got three daughters, and she's the one who, you know, we've kept that tradition going. Mm-hmm. So we've been reading some of the classics, but Tessa D'Urbervilles is the one that's really stood out. And I think it's such a great novel to read as a writing student. It's got such a tight structure. Every scene is pushing the plot on. It's really visual. It reads like a screenplay. It doesn't seem to have aged in the same way in terms of language as something like Jane Eyre has, which is quite a difficult read and is all over the place in terms of point of view and tense. This one is absolutely spot on. It reads like a modern novel. I've been really surprised by that. There's a huge amount of foreshadowing of what's going to happen, this final event, no spoilers, final awful event at the end. There's blood imagery throughout, which I find quite shocking, actually. The story world is so vivid, the world of Beautiful Vale, where she comes from, the Vale where she goes then to milk the cows, the awful world of the rain and the frost up on the hill where she's working, where everything goes wrong. It's such a clever book, and you can see it unravelling from the first chapter. You can see the seeds of what's going to happen unfurling in that very tight way. But why it speaks to me at the moment, I think, is because in the world of Me Too and Harvey Weinstein, Thomas Hardy was able to comment on this in 1890, whenever it was that he wrote it. It is that story. It's the story of an abusive relationship of power between Tess and two men. And reading that with a 15-year-old seems incredibly resonant. and you could pull out lines from this and quote them now, and they would be adding to the debate we're all having about Me Too. It's just the clarity of it, the tight structure. I think if you're looking for a book as a novice writer to look at how structure works, yeah, this works brilliantly. Yeah.
Okay, so that was Tessa the D'Urbervilles. Yes, I think that's probably worth rereading.
Yeah.
So just to have a look at that plotting, as we talked about last week.
And as I said, Thomas Hardy, brilliant at plotting, absolutely. Yeah. Mayor of Casterbridge is another one that's got this circular structure.
Okay, and finally, last but not least, Linda, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I ran across a very interesting book, author I've never heard of. Her name is Lucia Berlin. Have any of you ever heard of Lucia Berlin?
No, I haven't.
Well, it turns out that she kind of was low-key as a writer. In fact, she told someone in one interview, they said, how do you get your work out? And she said, well, most of her work was published in, you know, the little publications like university presses or something. And she, other than that, she kind of waits for editors to find her. But she was a short story writer, and she wrote, I think, 76 short stories in her career. She had a terrible struggle with alcoholism and finally licked it, thank goodness. But she writes in a way that I was drawn to the title when I was looking through a list of books for my e-reader. And her title, this one, was A Manual for Cleaning Women. And I just thought, oh, that's
for cleaning women?
Yes.
Or for cleaning women.
A Manual for Cleaning Women. That book, these stories were first published in 1977, and I think they're now re-released in, I think, 2015.
I already want to read them.
You what?
I already want to read them now.
I'm off to you.
Well, and she's got a wonderful sense of place. She really feels that's very important. She's mostly in the West. She writes strange stories. I don't know how to say it. They're very interesting, but it's different writing, different from anything I've seen before. And I just thought this, well, for example, in one of her stories, there's a young woman. I'd say I think of her as pre-adolescent or just adolescent. And her grandfather makes dentures, false teeth for people. And he's very good at it. He's just expert. And he's made one pair that he considers to be absolutely perfect. And they are for him. However, he still has his teeth. And at one point, he calls his granddaughter, to pull his teeth for him. So he gets in the chair, has a bottle of whiskey. He starts to drink his whiskey. And then she starts to work with the dental instrument.
Oh, my God.
And she can't complete it. No, it's a wonderful story. And
we'll take your word for it.
There's more. You've got to read.
But don't tell me any more because I want to read them.
Okay. Lucia Berlin, A Manual for Cleaning Women.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Sounds really good.
Strange.
Well, that's it till next week, I'm afraid.
Oh, you sound so sad, Stephanie.
It's been another fun week, ladies. Thank you very much. And thank you for joining us. Don't forget, if you'd like to contribute to Write Club, we'd love to hear from you. You can contribute to Bedside Table or the Amuse-Bouche section that you heard Pat do today on the vagaries of the English language. If you've got anything to say, just make a recording of whatever you want to say and email it to us. You'll find all the details on our Facebook group. We'd love to hear from you and we'd love you to get involved. Okay, so until next week then, goodbye.
Bye.